Hey, long live the rebels and pioneers. It's Christina Borgeson and
Celia Farber.
And we have an incredible show for you today. Very, very special guest, Greg Barnes. He is Julian Assange's legal representative in Australia. And besides being a barrister, which is what they call lawyers over there, he's a spokesperson for the Prison Action and Reform Group Incorporated and the Australian Lawyers Alliance. And we're having him on because we are very concerned about Julian. Everybody, I'm not going to say everybody, but a lot of people around the world are very concerned about Julian. And Celia over here has a long experience looking at some Swedish aspects of the case, because as you may or may not know, Celia lived in Sweden for a while.
I did, and I'm half Swedish. My mother was Swedish. I feel like Sweden is the missing, it's the piece of the story that doesn't tend to get invoked or invoked correctly what role Sweden played, which was not just pivotal, but utter.
Tell us
what
happened.
The whole thing went down.
Tell us what happened.
In Sweden. So Julian Assange went to Sweden in, oh dear.
It's okay if you can't
remember. Can you look up the year for me?
Okay, I'll look it up.
Still a free man and arrives as a rock star and is giving a talk. And the talk was arranged by a group called Brotherhood of the Social Democrats, Christian Social Democrats. This interesting kind of fusion between Social Democrats and it sounded like Christians, which are almost unheard of in Sweden. So I don't quite understand the group and who they were, but it was very. There was no money. We all know he always didn't want to stay in hotels. So it was, you know, he stayed in the home, catastrophically, of a woman who was one of the organizers of this event. Mistake number one. So he's there and he's having a very relaxed time. He's giving his talk. He's hanging out. He's going to crayfish parties. Women are all over him.
This was 2010.
And then the trouble begins. And because I'm Swedish and I speak Swedish, I was lucky to get a colleague in Sweden, Torbjörn Sassarsson, who I hope will come on the show sometime in the future. He's the editor of, I think, Sweden's only alternative news site called newsvoice.se. And he said, do you want a copy of the police report? And I said, yeah. So he sent it, and it hadn't been published. It was sort of going around, being passed around back then. And it was in Swedish, and I read the whole thing. It's about 100 pages. And it's a very very detailed, and at one point I wrote two pieces about it, and I said it's parts of it read sort of like a dime store novel, because you get everything, like the feelings of the, it's two women, as we all know, and that Julian Assange had sexual relations with, consensual, entirely consensual, not only consensual, but in both cases you can read a lot of detail in this Swedish police report about their strong feelings toward him. I mean, romantic feelings, and which one felt rejected,
so,
and when she felt rejected, and how.
So when did the rape occur at this time?
There's no rape in the entire story, in the police report. Even the two women, when they did go to the police station, and I'll tell you why in a second, they never said he raped them. They did not want any criminal charges pressed. What they wanted, and I wish everybody really understood this about this case, one of them, okay, there was a condom that broke with both women. Condom broke.
Oh.
One of them became hysterical, and I mean hysterical, to the point of vomiting, because she was so afraid she had caught HIV and was going to die of AIDS because the condom broke. Yes.
Okay.
And she had never been exposed to seminal fluid in her life. She was 20 something. Yeah. So, you know, just a very staunch believer in safe sex.
Right.
And so she tried to track him down. This was on a Saturday in Stockholm. He's going about his business and he's got meetings and talks. And she's calling and calling and she says, I need you to go take an HIV test. And he agrees to do this. He says, I'm not HIV positive. I'll have an HIV test. But he wouldn't do it right then and there, stop what he was doing and go get one right away on a Saturday in Stockholm. Wisely, because HIV tests have certainly been known to be rigged against politically targeted people.
Right.
So he says, I'll do it my way. I'll do it when I want to have more time to figure out in which clinic and how I should do that. Then the other woman who he also had sexual relations with, she was older and she was more of a, I guess you could say, more alpha. She was the organizer of the whole event. And I'm not naming these women's names, though I know their names. She got on the phone with, let's call her Woman A, and Woman B is the one who's hysterical about the HIV test. So Woman A gets on the phone with Woman B somehow, and they start to compare notes, and they find out that he's been with both of them. So feelings start to flare, and it's jealousy, and the older...
This is all in the police report?
All in the police report. I got to translate it for you sometime, Christina.
Okay.
And
all right.
So she says, I'm going to help you. So she takes the hysterical younger one sort of under her protective wing says, we're going to go to the police and we're going to make them compel him to take this HIV test now. You know. So that's why they went to the police, to see if the police could compel Julian Assange to come right in and do whatever they said regarding this HIV test.
Hold up, because the Swedish, you know, the reports are, I mean, I'm looking at one right here that says the Swedish prosecutor's office issued an arrest warrant for two allegations, one of rape and one of molestation. So you're saying that in this police report that you read, there was no record of a rape?
No, I'll tell you.
No record?
Okay. No record of a rape. There was, in the first instance, it's the woman whose apartment he was staying in, and they went out to dinner, and they came home, and they had a consensual sexual
experience.
There was a moment she described as uncomfortable, in which he, I think her pearl necklace broke. But she said it had moved a little faster than she would have wanted.
Oh my God! I bet every man listening to this is like
going,
the hairs rising on the back of their neck while something else goes down, because if you from the beginning to the end of, you know, before, during, and after sex, you have to worry about when it might turn into a rape. That's crazy.
You know, and I wrote this in my piece, and I want to say it now. I feel conflicted talking about this because it's invasive as all get out to Julian Assange, but it's the only way to address.
Well, it's the thing that started his nightmare.
And it's
sort of like. It's like the Gulf of Tonkin incident, you know? It's kind of a false flag.
And there's no
and
there,
what we need
there
to
quote. Who am I quoting? There's no there there. Peter Strzok, one of those guys, admitted there's no there there in the Mueller report. There's no there there in the Julian Assange Swedish police rape report.
But how can the Swedish prosecutor's office say that he raped them and that there was molestation if the police report itself doesn't say that?
Okay, so I think I can answer that.
Okay.
It went like this. When the two women got to the police station and gave their story, so now they're upset with him. Follow it like a novel.
Okay.
They're pissed.
Right.
He's been with both of them. They're all, and he went, he didn't disclose to the one that he was going.
Right.
So they're in the police office there, and their report is being taken by, I think, I know she was a woman. perhaps older than they were and a staunch feminist, and which goes without saying in Sweden. And she got her, what do you call it?
Dander up
and said, I'm calling this, the Swedish phrase is sexuellt ofredande, which means sexual dispeace. So now you have to understand the Swedish. I know it's getting weird.
Oh, no, now we have degrees. It's not rape, but it's sexual dispeace.
Well, I'm pulling out the accordion now. Accordion. And this is how broad the Swedish rape law is.
Okay.
It's very all-encompassing. It stretches all the way to marital nagging on one end.
What? You can go to jail for marital nagging?
Nagging? That if you're married, you nag your wife. You're married and you're in bed and you nag her and nag her and nag her. And she says, no, I don't want to. I have a headache. And you nag her.
She can call the cops?
Yes. It's happened that men have served time for that.
That is
crazy. There are extreme rape laws, which I know does not fit at all with what we're reading all day about
exactly. The
rape pandemic
in
Sweden. Yeah. Completely different story, which we'll have to get to another time.
So let's get
back to this. They're in the police station. And so she ratchets it up, the police.
The woman actually
adds
to the novel herself as opposed to letting them
and
just...
And she says, I'm going to call this...
Yeah, sexual dispiece.
Sexual dispiece slash... You know, the word rape features here and there, but there are all these other words that kind of like a ladder lead up to that word that aren't really
but
rape.
But this is all out of the mind of the woman, not the two girls.
And the two girls start crying, saying, no, stop, we don't want that. We don't want that. We just want you to make him take an HIV test.
Right.
He didn't rape us. We don't want criminal charges brought against him.
Oh, my God.
But now the snowball is snowballing, right? And it seems to be that it's kind of out of their hands. And so the fix is in and what happens next, which is what disturbs me the most. I don't know the exact timeline. I don't have the piece that I wrote in front of me, but very quickly, his face is on the cover of the number one newspaper, the evening paper, Expressen in Sweden. And it's his face, despite the fact that there are laws in Sweden that you cannot show the face of an accused rapist. They have to be pixelated, not Julian Assange. His face, the word rape.
But I don't understand
so
how they can...
So it launched in the press.
But how could he be accused of rape when the girls themselves... Was that documented in the police report that the girl said, no, we don't want him?
Yes, everything is documented
so
in the
that...
police report. So it takes on a life... I know, it takes on a life of its own when the Swedish press goes off half-cocked and says Julian Assange is going to be charged with rape, and he is being called in for questioning. And you know how these things are. Once somebody sees that word, that no one's going to go back and look at the details anymore.
Yeah, but apart from
there was no charge. I'm waffling too much on the. Let me just get right to it. Julian Assange was never charged with rape in Sweden. He was.
But why was an arrest warrant issued for him then?
They want it because in Sweden, as our guest will explain to us, you can arrest somebody. This is very key, and I just learned this. You can arrest somebody in order to question them. So they were. Sweden is basically at this moment in the history going, we're not really happy with how you treated our girls. We want to question you. This is not how we do things here in Sweden. And so they were going to arrest him to question him. And we'll clarify this and make sure I'm right when Greg comes on.
Okay.
To question him. And that's when all hell breaks loose. Okay. Because so they question him, and the first answers that he gave caused them to completely drop the case. Case is gone, done. Now it's thrown to another prosecutor who picks it up.
Why is it thrown? If it's done, if it's shut, why is it?
I would say deep state, backdoor, you know.
Well, somebody said, oh, no, let's keep this going.
Someone said, you have this guy, you know, and I don't know what came first. I don't know if it was a a honeypot thing. Nobody knows. Julian Assange is on record saying he has never said that this was a CIA plot to begin with.
Okay.
With these two
well,
girls,
then let's but, just take him at his word.
Yeah. So, so now he. Let's see. Where are we now in the timeline?
So somebody else is told to pick up the case. Somebody else picks up the case.
Yes. And her name is Marianne Nee, N-Y. And she is absolutely zealous, absolutely irrational, is on record. And I've seen the quote in Swedish newspapers. She's on record saying, even if I'm wrong, I'll never stop.
Wow.
Yeah. She just has it out for him. Right. So she.
But is that legal to pursue somebody like speciously like that? I mean, that's harassment.
Sweden is Sweden. It's its own.
Well, no, what does that mean?
Well, it's an extreme society that has a way of doing things that's not recognizable to Western
nations.
When you
have some,
I would say
that is an ethical problem for this woman, for her to
she should
telegraph.
It's prosecutorial misconduct.
Yes,
absolutely.
Well,
she should be yes.
And because, you know, this is the thing I think we're going to see all along the way with this case, how there are formal laws on the books, but somehow none of those formal laws
apply to Julian Assange.
Are being applied to Julian Assange. And that alone should scare the hell out of everybody.
That's right.
And because if they can do this to Julian...
Right.
You know, and Julian has done big things, but what happens is when those laws are thrown out the window and somebody is prosecuted because those laws have not been applied, then a precedent is set, and now they can go after other people for lesser things. And the lesser things become even less and less and less until finally they're at your door, and they're at my door, and they're at your neighbor's door. For some ridiculous, and now you're in, you know, the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
absolutely.
So I can hear you typing.
Oh, let me tell you, I'm trying to call up the quote from this.
But anyway, so she said she was going to get him. But let's move on.
Yeah.
With this
okay.
Story,
well, let me. The most important thing that people understand this is a big morass. This thing, but most importantly, May 2017. Swedish prosecutors dropped all charges against Julian Assange after reviewing the evidence in other words, did you hear what I said? Dropped all charges, meaning they never had a rape case against Julian Assange. They wanted to build one, and they never achieved a case. Julian Assange has never been charged with rape in Sweden.
Okay.
Did you know that? It was all trying to get to
well,
that.
Well, they were trying to create a case out of, you know, a police report that wouldn't allow them to, basically.
Right.
And then they brought on this other woman who was determined to try, and she had a go at it. And then now what's the jumping bail situation? When did that happen?
Yeah, so he was, I think we should talk to Greg about that. Let me answer this instead. First of all, that one of the smears against Assange is the idea that he kind of ran away from the Swedish prosecutors and wouldn't be questioned, which is completely false. So after the incidents took place that summer in Stockholm, for which he was wanted for questioning, that was mid-August 2010, he remained in Sweden for 5 weeks until September 27th. And in that time, as I told you, the Swedish prosecutors once dropped the case altogether and then reopened it a few days later. And I found the quote from the second prosecutor, the zealous one, Marianne Nee, who said, "Even if I'm wrong, I won't give up." So he winds up, in effect, being... Here's what happened. Let me simplify it. In the global media, which was, you know, we know media is largely affiliated with various the global deep state. So global deep state media charges Julian Assange with rape in all of its outlets all over the world. So it becomes like this engulfing psyop about Julian Assange, while the actual rape, the actual prosecutor, we have one prosecutor who drops it, another prosecutor who wastes many years and refuses to go to the embassy in London to interview him. That's another thing. Swedish prosecutor did not go to embassy to question him.
Okay.
Finally, they did. It was an elaborate negotiation. They finally did. And what happens? They drop it. They have no case. So the world should be livid at Sweden. You had no case. You got all right. him into this mess, and you had no case.
So he fled between the first shutting down and the second opening of the second time?
Or let's see. So he doesn't flee Sweden ever. He leaves Sweden peacefully. He's been there for 5 weeks after this incident.
Right.
Nobody says, we have to question you. This is serious. None of that happens.
When does
and
he goes go to the embassy?
Goes to London.
Oh, okay.
And honestly, in London, I'm not sure what happens. What did it? But, well, we know he goes at some point into the Ecuadorian embassy, and that's the moment when he's accused of skipping.
Yeah, but what's the jumping bail? I mean, the thread on which they're trying to get to him to extradite him is for jumping bail.
Well,
right?
Let's ask our guest that when he comes on, because that's that little piece right there. I've never understood that.
Okay, well, good, because that's where we'll pick up the story. Our guest is coming up on the half hour. He's a very, very busy man. And but there is one thing that we would like to announce that you, Celia, discovered, right, about Julian's mom. You've been in touch with Julian's mom.
Yeah, Christine Assange, those who have followed this know that she campaigns absolutely ceaselessly for her son on social media and especially Twitter. And just before I came to the studio today, I saw that her account, it actually hasn't been shut down, but there's like a barricade on it. It says that there's been events around this page, and you have to go to a special, click on something if you still want to enter the page. You can access it, but it's kind of shuttered.
It's just really crazy. I mean, I don't know. We'll talk to Greg about this, but it just seems like there's certain moves and pieces that are being put into place in more and more expeditiously, I should say, to sort of get at him. And I think part of it is because something has to be done before his health completely breaks down and, you know, something happens to him in that embassy proper, you know. And these are some of the things we want to discuss is who is responsible for the fact that this guy has, I mean, basically it's a form of torture if you really look at it. If you have to stay in one room, no sunlight, you know, and it starts to affect all kinds of you start to have neurological problems, you start to have other physical problems, psychological problems possibly. I mean, it's a form of, you know, boiling frogs, torture.
Absolutely.
You know?
If I can, speaking of frogs, leapfrog back to what we were talking about a minute ago, because I pulled up my piece here.
That was a good
I just want you to hear this. This is from the police report of a guy named Donald Bostrom, who was one of the journalists who was on the scene and was, you know, at all these crayfish parties hanging out with Assange and these women. And here's what he says. Based on Anna's story, when she called me, she said, we had sex, and that's what happened. And she made no reference to any kind of assault. She did not want to go to the police. My sense is that she did not experience this as serious, but got pissed off.
Wow.
That's just one. The piece, if anybody's listening to this wants to read it, is at www.theinditer.com, I-N-D-I-C-T-E-R, which is a Swedish human rights
periodical. I mean, this is, you know, I've dealt with a lot of law enforcement people, and I have a friend who's he was one of those black ops guys, and, you know, I think this was, in the case of Assange, this was a an opportunistic moment for his enemies to come after him,
yeah,
and the state to come after him. But, you know, sex, is, you know, this is older than,
yep,
you know, the ages, using sex to create problems for
and a man. In fact, one of his Swedish male colleagues had warned him, it's chilling, exactly of that when he came to Stockholm. And he's just having a time. He said, Julian, please watch out. You know, that's the oldest trick in the book. And Julian said something to the effect of, you know, I know what I'm doing.
Julian was feeling as though, let's face it, a young man. Mm-hmm. But you know,
and there's a lot in the police report about how women just threw themselves at him, and they just he just had that, you know, and
well, power, you know, a man with power is irresistible to a lot of women.
Yeah,
know?
The Swedish guys were kind of humorously flabbergasted at how magnetic he was.
The magnetic geek.
How the women responded to him in a way they did not respond to them. So,
well, power is the aphrodisiac, but, you know, I mean,
well, when you
to
read
think
the
that this was the point of departure to what is now, look at this.
I know,
it's
that
a
it grew
huge
and grew
issue
and grew, yeah.
that now has at stake, you know, it has press freedom on a very, very fundamental base level, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, the biggest problem, one of the biggest problems with the press corruption that we have globally, is the inability of the press, for reasons of, you know, who owns them, to, you know, self-censoring journalists and so on, this whole landscape of censorship, this inability to achieve accountability against massive criminal behavior, large crimes, state crimes, huge crimes on the parts of major corporations. And, of course, these are the power centers of the world. So if there can't be any accountability in these quarters, then we have to understand that this is, well, let's not even talk about democracy anymore, because
yeah,
everything
agreed.
Is so rigged.
Everything's
but, you
so
know,
rigged.
People have to start thinking about, you know, what we're living in here, you know, and it's across the globe. And, you know, they keep changing the laws and pushing. And Assange is at the forefront of this. I mean, they're trying to get Assange because he exposed massive war crimes.
Yeah.
I think Greg is coming on soon.
I want to get Greg on as quickly as possible. But may I please just read you one quick passage before we bring this? You've got
okay.
to hear this.
Okay.
Okay. This is from... this is from the police report. On the night of August 14th, Mr. Assange said goodbye to Ms. Villian and after their afternoon rendezvous, and went to Ms. Ardine's crayfish party. He and Ms. Villian were in touch via phone messages over the next few days, when Ms. Villian became increasingly frustrated that Mr. Assange is hard to reach or make firm plans with. Monday, August 16, the pair finally meet. They start making out again, dot, 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 dot. They have to take a commuter train from central Stockholm to her suburb. Once again, she has to pay for his train ticket. By the time the slow commuter train delivered the pair to their destination, the bloom was off. They took off their shoes, and things between them didn't feel warm anymore. This is her testimony. And she said things like... you know, they were brushing their teeth. It was midnight, and it felt domestic and boring. So, you know, you get these kinds of details, like,
it is like a novel.
It's just unbelievable. So that, you know, the whole thing. That's what's so incredible, that it comes out of this moment. Something so mundane,
yeah,
and banal,
yeah,
and a few people who had their feelings slightly hurt somewhere. So, you know, just the most ordinary
it's
stuff
like now
we
you're
all
going,
go through.
Now we go from the microbial this whole situation to the global universal. I mean, it's universal for us. You know, the global. You know, the whole world is looking at these states passing laws and trying to crush people who are exposing their criminal
exactly.
behavior.
And to think that this situation can come from that is just unbelievable.
So I'm just wondering if Greg is on the line yet. I'm sorry? 3 to 4 minutes. Oh, we still have 3 to 4 minutes before he can get on. He is a busy guy. But, you know, that's the thing that's so terrifying. And I don't think, I think the reporting in this country has done a very, very good job of keeping that awareness on the back burner. Instead, you know, the story is this guy is a traitor. He's, you know, traitor to, well, to the American efforts around the world.
And let me tell you what else they've conflated. Him being in the embassy, and then people who are against him say that he's hiding out. Why doesn't he just face it, like face his rape charges like a man and walk out of there?
There are no rape charges, folks.
There are no rape charges, and he's in the embassy because he has no guarantee from the United States that we won't extradite him here and charge him for God only knows what, even though we're not, we presumably have no legal right to do so, but he knows the he knows this game. He knows this global deep state game. So he's not in, he was never in the embassy fleeing Swedish charges. He tried to get them to come and interview him, and he was in Sweden for 5 weeks after this happened.
Well, I'm still trying to figure
out. It's the Swedes who wouldn't come to him.
No, no, but I'm still trying to figure out.
Or question him when he was in Stockholm for 5 weeks.
He didn't go back. He wouldn't go back to Sweden, right?
Right. He planned to actually live in Sweden before all this went
down.
He was thinking of living there.
But my question to you is, oh, there's this bail jumping thing. I mean, for some reason, he's beholden to UK justice, isn't he? For some reason.
Yes, that's a good point. So he's in this house at some point in the history of all this in the UK. A friend, you know that house? He stayed in a house and he was under some kind of house arrest. And what we're asking is why? So I think what happened is that after he leaves Sweden, the mushroom cloud from Sweden follows him to the UK.
Okay.
And now he's wanted for questioning in Sweden, but he's in the UK. So why couldn't the Swedes question him when he was in Sweden? Don't know. They had 5 weeks. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
So now he's in the UK, and now he has to be under house arrest. And I think he's beginning to see how this is all coming together. Eventually takes asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy. But we're going to have to get our guest.
It says here he initially took asylum to avoid being extradited to Sweden.
Extradited to Sweden?
Yeah. Probably for the second, right?
Okay, yeah.
The second investigation, and then that investigation was dropped. So why is he still
I think that at that point in time, he realizes that Sweden is crazy land and there is no justice and nothing is being done properly. And they're in deep collaboration with U.S., U.K.
That's what he said. He said that the charge was a ploy that would eventually take him to the U.S. where prosecutors were preparing to pursue a criminal
case. Sweden has a solid record of extraditing people to the
U.S.
But
Britain says Assange will be arrested for skipping bail if he leaves the embassy.
It's just like this cat's cradle. It doesn't start anywhere. It doesn't end anywhere. It's a one in a...
There's a bail violation in the UK.
So what? I'm not saying so what to you, but I mean, they act like... And do you know how many, presumably tens or even hundreds of millions of pounds have been spent by the British government, taxpayer money, to stand guard outside that embassy?
Yeah, well, supposedly. I mean, this guy is a real problem. He's a real problem for all those states, because if he inspires people on the inside, particularly in the military, particularly in their major corporate institutions, etc., to expose malfeasance through leaked documents, you know, the jig is up for a lot of very powerful people and institutions.
Right.
You know? And that can't be, because they consider themselves the global structure, you know?
Well, WikiLeaks, as we know, continues to publish. And what's fascinating, we haven't had a chance to talk much about Assange's model of journalism, which is a revolutionary model. So it goes from gatekeepers, Mockingbird media gatekeepers, maybe this, maybe that, a lot of speculation in the media, to raw documentation.
Exactly.
That's that's how he moves the ball.
A curated platform of raw documentation.
Right. As in, we don't need to speculate anymore. It's documentation or it's nothing.
Right.
And that is...
Okay. We've got Greg on the line.
Mr. Barnes.
You have indeed.
Welcome.
Yes.
Welcome, welcome. We're so glad to hear your voice.
Yeah, we've gotten Thank ourselves you. Ensnared here a little bit in the first half hour trying to fill in pieces of the Julian Assange saga since that trip to Stockholm in 2010. So we're very relieved to have you and welcome and thanks. And we haven't mentioned where you're calling us from.
I'm calling you from Hobart, Tasmania, Australia.
That is a first for us.
So. Yeah, I'll bet you it's a first. Yeah, yeah.
So we want to get right to it because we don't have a lot of time with you.
Sure.
But you know, there are these questions that we were asking about this bail charge. Why would he have to serve any time in UK for a bail charge? How did that come up?
Well, I think that normally what happens is if you breach a condition of your bail, you have to go into detention for a very short period, either to be re-bailed or for the matter to be dealt with in court. I don't think he would serve any time. The risk for him is that if he left the embassy, he was arrested because he breached his bail. In between that time and going to court, which could be a day or two, the Americans could simply file an extradition warrant and seek to have him extradited to the United States while he's in detention. He would have to remain in detention while that extradition request was heard.
Okay, so there are two questions here. One is, this bail charge is related to the charges that were dropped, right?
So the bail, that's right, but he was on bail in relation to what's called a European arrest warrant. There were no charges in Sweden. There was simply a request by a Swedish prosecutor to interview him.
Yeah.
The way the European law works is that, in Sweden anyway, is that an arrest warrant can be filed in the UK so that a person can be detained and then they can be examined. So it wasn't in relation to charges, it was purely to question. What happened was that he then sought asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy, so he didn't, in other words, he breached his bail by failing to attend to court, and he's been there ever since.
Okay, so there's no dropping the bail charges because the initial charges were found.
Right, that's what we were thinking. Since Sweden dropped the rape case,
it's important. It's important to note, though, that there were no charges initially. There was simply a request by a Swedish prosecutor to interview him in relation to some allegations that had been made.
Right,
they weren't
no
charged.
Charges.
It was just a
yeah. Indeed.
So couldn't they drop this bail business?
Him so they could be questioned. Well, I think the difficulty, bail law in the UK is pretty similar to the United States and Australia, and that is that, generally speaking, if you breach your bail by failing to attend or failing to deliver the particular address, etc., they won't withdraw it. Normally, you simply go to the court, you get a rap on the knuckles, and off you go. My view is he wouldn't do any time given the circumstances of this particular matter. But the risk is that he would be detained even for a very short period pending the bail hearing, that's when the Americans could strike.
Okay, so here's another very naive question, but I'm hoping a lot of our audience is naive too about this. But what right does the United States have to impose a U.S. law? It would be the extradition act, right? On an Australian citizen.
Well, look, in relation to extradition, countries all around the world have treaties with each other where they're able to extradite individuals who are wanted in that particular jurisdiction. So, for example, Australia has an extradition treaty with the UK. If there were charges filed in an Australian court and the person was living in London, Australian police could go to London, file an extradition warrant, have the person arrested, and then bring the person back to Australia.
No, I understand that.
Has an extradition.
I understand the extradition process, but what American law
You're talking about the charges. You're talking about the charges.
What American law has he broken?
So none in our view, and it's hard to know what it is that the U.S. Department of Justice is trying to achieve. One assumes what they're trying to say is that there's some breach because of publication, because of an alleged link with Manning, that there's some breach of United States laws in relation to espionage, state secrets, etc. It's hard to know. But what we do know is that it's very significant and very concerning that the United States would seek to extend the reach of its domestic laws to an Australian citizen who's now also an Ecuadorian citizen and who did not publish, the act of publication did not take place in the United States in the sense that he wasn't in the US when these matters were published.
Right.
But furthermore, it wasn't WikiLeaks acting on its own. There were a number of newspapers and media organisations around the world that participated, and they included the New York Times. But no one talks about prosecuting the editors of the New York Times.
Yeah, I can assure you, Mr. Barnes, the U.S. Department of Justice is not in a moment of high credibility in this country right now.
So let me ask you something else. Let me ask you something else. So he's there in that embassy, and his health is bad. His health is declining, and it's almost like a form of extended torture for him to be there. I mean, can a case be made for that, or is that just, you know?
Well, certainly a ruling by the United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention, a very clear ruling that says that he is being arbitrarily detained, and that does include the fact that, or arbitrary detention can include the fact that it effectively amounts to cruel and unusual punishment and or torture. So there is already a United Nations working group ruling in relation to this matter.
But what about the Australian government? Can't they be held accountable for that?
We've certainly in Australia had some dealings with the Australian government. What I can say is that the previous foreign minister, who's now retired, or perhaps retired, Julie Bishop, did in fact grant Julian's request to get a passport. We had some productive dealings with the Australian government earlier this year. Sadly, we're now in election mode in Australia, and what we need to do, of course, is put Julian's case into the middle of that election campaign and get some commitments out of leaders.
Yes.
I can say also that Julian's father and myself briefed a number of what we call crossbench senators and members of parliament, in other words, those who don't belong to the major parties, and we've got strong support from a number of those people who hold key positions in Canberra and the nation's capital. But the Australian government ought to be doing a lot more. We did see 15 years ago now, David Hicks, who was an Australian who ended up in Guantanamo Bay. There was considerable community pressure on the then Conservative government to bring him back to Australia. That happened. The precedent has been set. The Australian government has an obligation, we would say a humanitarian obligation, to ensure that its citizens are not subjected to torture and cruel and unusual punishment. And certainly a lot more should be done by the Australian government.
You know, you have something you want to say.
I heard Mr. Barnes in another interview that you gave where you said that they're not, and we all know this, he hasn't even been permitted to be transported to a hospital or to a clinic or to a dentist to get any kind of medical care.
He's not permitted?
And that has been even, what did you say, even prisoners have that right. Is that right if they need medical care?
Well, prisoners absolutely have that right, if it's not done, then they can take action to make sure it's done. But the second point I'd make is that one would have thought the United Kingdom government would show some humanity by at least allowing him to, even if he goes under armed guard to hospital or to medical appointments and returns to the embassy. That's just sheer humanity, which would allow that. But the British government has taken the attitude that he can stay in the embassy and we're not going to allow him, you know, the basic human rights to be exercised. It's appalling conduct on the part of the UK government.
It really
is. Mr. Barnes, when was the last time you spoke to Julian Assange? Or had contact with him of any kind?
I communicate with him. Yeah, no, look, I pretty regularly, in fact, last week. And I speak to his father and mother, who are both in Australia. I'm regularly in contact with both of them. They're both great campaigners for their son. But I certainly stay in touch with Julian. And look, there are a lot of Australians who support Julian strongly. As I say, I think it's important that we start holding our political leaders to account. For too long now, they've been able to simply say, oh, look, this is a matter for the US and the UK. Australia is, of course, a close ally of the US, also a close ally of the UK. It could, if it wanted to, get heavily involved in this matter and broker a deal in order for Julian to be able to leave the embassy without the fear of him being subjected to a very arbitrary and capricious and oppressive United States justice process.
What are they trying to get? What are they trying to get out of Manning? What are they trying to get Manning to say that would?
One assumes that what they're trying to do is put a link between Manning and Assange and confirm a link, if you like, between Manning and Assange. Manning has always said that she voluntarily provided information to WikiLeaks. Secondly, she's given reams of testimony in the military justice setting. And so one wonders why the Department of Justice is continuing to pursue her. But I assume that that's what...
But what kind of link? I mean, obviously there's a link in that she provided the information to the documents to Assange, but...
I think what they're trying to do is if I'm putting on a prosecutor's hat for a minute, which is rare for me because I don't prosecute, but if I put on a prosecutor's hat for a minute... I assume what they're trying to do is to say that there was some form of conspiracy between Assange and Manning to facilitate the leaking of this information.
So as if he solicited it. In other words, that the part is solicitation.
I assume that's what they're trying to say. And in fact, I think they've said that publicly. Now there is absolutely no evidence of that. The other point to make, of course, is that it was patently obvious that Chelsea Manning would stand on principle on this matter and not give evidence.
Right.
It's a pointless exercise in detaining her.
There's no evidence to give. From what I can tell.
There's no evidence to give. Exactly right. But also she's made the point she won't give evidence, and so to cite someone for contempt in those circumstances in the way that's been done, I think is pointless, because she's not going to change. I mean, normally with contempt proceedings, what you're trying to do is get the person to change their mind. She's not going to change her mind.
Right.
And so to lock her up, I think, is really oppressive again.
And at the same time, we're engulfed in this this bizarre pseudo-investigation called Russiagate in this country. And
yeah.
I was really, really wondering, and maybe this is a naive question, I don't know, but Robert Mueller believes that the premise of Russiagate is that the emails that were published on WikiLeaks in 2016 pertaining to the DNC, Hillary Clinton, John Podesta, that those were hacked by the Russians. And I know Julian Assange has always said no, it was not a foreign state. And we have Bill Binney and Ray McGovern and others over here saying forensically it's absolutely impossible that it was a hack, that it was instead was a download. And meanwhile, we have Robert Mueller, who, as far as I know, has made no attempt to interview Julian Assange about this. Am I right about that, as far as you know? That Mueller...
As far as I know, there's been no interview and no invitation to interview, as far as I know. I mean, Julian's US lawyers can speak more authoritatively on that. But
do you think Julian would agree to talk to Mueller if Mueller's people called?
Well, again, look, I'm going to defer to my US colleagues. I mean, we've got a global legal team on Julian's case, and I'm going to defer to my US colleagues.
Yeah, yeah. I feel that this is the rub.
But Julian has consistently said in relation to this matter exactly what you've just said. That is that it was not a hack. That this was came from inside the DNC. I think we ought to remember too, the revelations served the public interest in this sense. That,
exactly.
What they showed was that Hillary Clinton and her friends in the DNC were prepared to distort the rules, corrupt the rules of the party, in order to ensure that Bernie Sanders didn't get elected. Now, you know, I have a lot of people attack me out here and say, oh, you know, this helped Trump get elected. I think what people are forgetting is this, that Hillary Clinton was a terrible candidate, the worst possible candidate you could put up in the context of the political climate in the United States. And one doesn't have to be a Trump supporter, and I'm not a Trump supporter by any stretch of the imagination, but you don't have to be a Trump supporter to know that there are a whole range of reasons why Hillary Clinton didn't get elected. But focusing on the DNC email material, it did show and illustrated very well the corrupting influence of big money and inside political party interests in the United States, and of course, which happens in Australia and happens in the UK and elsewhere.
I want to ask you something else, which is talk about why are they going after him so hard? All these nations, the UK, Australia, America,
Sweden.
What are they afraid of? What is he doing that they can't?
Well, Sweden has dropped out of the race now, so we concentrate on the others. They are all members of the Coalition of the Willing in Iraq, in Afghanistan. And what Julian Assange has done is, in a historical sense, exposed these nations for the war crimes that they committed in those countries, for the lies that they told in terms of justifying their actions, and the terrible havoc that they've wreaked upon the populations of those countries. That makes him a public enemy when it comes to the security state and the defence forces who love to operate behind the veil of secrecy.
But if he goes down, what happens? What's the result?
Well,
what's
think,
the
I
result
think a
for...
A number of people have said... Well, I think a number of people have said, including Alan Rushbridge, the former editor of The Guardian... New York Times, lawyers in the United States, I've certainly said this will have a very chilling effect on ensuring that states are kept accountable for their actions, are made accountable for their actions. If we're going to start jailing people for life or even for lengthy periods of time, any time for that matter, on the basis that they are publishing what is clearly in the public interest, then this is a very, very dangerous development for democracies.
I really want to ask you, how is his morale, if you're able to speak to that? Does he believe he will be free, and does he still have hope and strength?
Well, I think Julian has remarkable resilience, extraordinary resilience, I'd have to say, that most of us, I think, would have gone stir crazy being locked up in a confined space in a 100-year-old or more, I think, 120-year-old apartment in London. So he's got extraordinary resilience. But, you know, there is an element of cruelty to what's happening, and there needs to be an end point. Governments cannot allow a situation where a person who seeks asylum is not allowed to then go to the country which has given him asylum, but is in fact locked up in an embassy. It just is untenable. And there needs to be a resolution of this matter.
Is it true that they're trying to bribe the Ecuadorian government with an IMF loan or something to make things more difficult for him? Or to even expel him?
Certainly been a change in attitude on the part of the Ecuadorian government, and certainly I've seen those reports about the IMF. And I mean, the United States, of course, is perfidious when it comes to its actions in relation to developing world countries. We know that.
Yes.
There would be no surprise that it would put fiscal pressure on countries in order to get to bend their will. But certainly, look, Ecuador did the right thing in providing asylum. It has supported these asylum. It needs to, and it was reminded last week by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. It was reminded of its obligations. Having given a person asylum, it has to protect that person's rights. It received that reminder last week.
Is there a race against time here to get a resolution before the Americans? It seems like they're trying to move in for the kill. They're going after Manning, you know, that 2018 addition to the extradition law, but the Espionage Act about not speaking ill of the military and the former government, blah blah blah. It seems like it seems like they're crowding. They're doing something.
Yeah,
am I right?
This moment? What moment are we in?
Well, it's not just in the United States. It's not just in the United States. Let me just give you a couple of Australian cases. There is an Australian lawyer called Bernard Collaery who, with individuals, revealed at the International Court of Justice some years ago that Australia had spied on East Timor, you know, an impoverished nation to its north, because they were in a dispute over a gas field. He now finds himself before the courts in Australia charged with breaching various pieces of legislation.
Wow.
That's one case. There's another case of a man who worked for the Australian Taxation Office in Australia, or equivalent to your IRS, who again blew the whistle, now facing potentially life imprisonment. You know, we are living at so it's not just the United States doing this. The other nations are doing this, and we are waging a war. Our governments are waging a war on freedom of speech, but more importantly and more dangerously, they are waging a war on accountability.
Exactly.
Anyone who's seeking to keep a government accountable is finding themselves now facing the blowtorch from prosecutors and their political masters.
We've got to close, but I want to tell you that we're so deeply grateful to you for coming on, and please give our best to Julian.
I appreciate it. And I appreciate the opportunity, and thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Mr. Barnes. We hope you'll come back sometime. Thank you. It was really an honor to speak to you.
Thank you very much.